My name is Meite Dupuy, and I'm very glad to be here to teach you about this quite exciting topic, which is quantum gravity. So I'm research associate professor at the University of Waterloo in the Applied Math Department, and I'm working in loop quantum gravity and spin foam models, okay? So I really think that Waterloo is one of the best places for you guys to learn about quantum gravity, because at least in the loop quantum gravity community, it's one of the biggest groups that we have here. So with Bianca, Laurent, and Lee at PI that you should already have at least seen in the corridor or at the bistro. And I'm at the University of Waterloo with Florian. So during this course, I'm going to focus on the loop quantum gravity approach and talk a bit about the spin foam models, which are the main topics of research of these four faculties here. So here you also have many postdoc PhD students, and I don't know if you already know him, but Clément will be your TA. So Clément is doing his PhD with Bianca. So don't hesitate to ask him questions. He will be really happy to talk with you. Okay, so today I have chosen to do a quite non-technical introduction to try to motivate what is quantum gravity, why quantum gravity. So I know that you like more technical stuff, so don't worry. It's the only day where I'm going to use slides, and tomorrow I'm going to use a blackboard with many equations and everything. So just today is going to be a bit less technical. And so the first part will be try to answer these two questions. What is quantum gravity? Why quantum gravity? Because as you should already know, one of the issues with quantum gravity is that there is no cause from experimentally accessible situation where one needs to quantize gravity for their description, okay? And gravity is not a very important force in the microscopic realm where one expects that quantum effects become dominant. So to understand this, you can just look at the ratio of the gravitational force between a proton and an electron and the electromagnetic force between still a proton and an electron, and you can see that the gravitational force is 10 to the power minus 40 weaker, okay? So that's what makes things quite hard with quantum gravity, because this is the root cause of why ever today we do not have any single experiment that requires quantum gravity. So this means that what we are trying to do is to try to build a theory without any experimental guidance, okay? So this is really what makes quantum gravity also difficult. And so hopefully when I will have answered these two questions, I will give you a kind of big picture of what is loop quantum gravity. Try to give you the picture and some vocabulary already. Okay, so what do we know about the elementary physical world, or what are you supposed to know? So we have quantum mechanics, which is a general framework for describing the dynamics. Then we have the standard model of particle physics, which describes all matter we have so far directly observed with its non-gravitational interaction, of course. So in the standard model, we have the three interactions: the strong interaction, electromagnetic interaction, and weak interaction. And then we have GR, general relativity, which is a theory which describes gravity, space, and time. And as you should know, all these theories have been quite well verified experimentally. A few years ago, even the Higgs boson was observed at the CERN as predicted by the standard model. So this means that up to now, we don't have any deviation from observed from the standard model we have. Okay, so this means again that we don't have any experimental guidance here. Everything we know is described by the standard. We observe is described by the standard model. And last year, 1 year ago now, gravitational waves were detected for the first time 100 years after the prediction by general relativity. So again, general relativity is quite well checked. So why do we need a theory of quantum gravity? And how can we find a theory of quantum gravity where everything we observe is so well described by the theory we already have? But you anyway, you should know that it's not the final story about the elementary world. And among the open problem, let's just mention the dark matter problem, where we know that the open problem is that empirically, 85% of the galactic and cosmological matter is likely not to be of the kind described by the standard model. Then another problem we could mention is the problem of unification, where here the idea would be that a common framework can be found to describe the three interactions entering in the standard model and the gravitational interaction. Okay, so up to now, the standard model is only describing three forces, so we still have the gravitational interaction. And then, of course, we have the quantum gravity problem, which is the problem we discussed in this lecture, and it's not necessarily related to the first two. Okay, so I'm going to discuss about this problem independently. I'm not going to talk anymore about these two other issues. So this is just some, of course, open problem. And so what do we expect from a theory of quantum gravity? Quantum gravity, usually we mean that we want to put together quantum mechanics and general relativity. And in the approach followed in loop quantum gravity to build a theory of quantum gravity, we start from the idea that gravity is a property of space-time. So let's see what we know about space-time, okay? So space-time is described by general relativity, but we know that all physics, if we don't talk about general relativity, all physics that we know about is based on a classical space-time. And this means that we are describing fields and particles living on a fixed space-time, whereas the Einstein discovery tells us that the gravitational field is space-time is the gravitational field. Okay, and so space-time and the gravitational field are the same entity. So this means that now we need to quantize the field without a background space-time. Okay, and this is again another difficulty of quantum gravity. And so, what does it mean the lack? What does it mean the lack of background structure? So technically, this is going to translate by the fact that we have a diffeomorphism invariance symmetry. Okay. So I don't know if you already, I guess you're already familiar with that, but we are going to come back on this symmetry very soon. And so general relativity is also teaching us that geometry is a manifestation of space-time. So this means that what we want to, so and geometry deals with quantities such as areas, volume, length, angles. So these are quantities which are determined by the gravitational field. So what we are trying to get, a theory of quantum gravity, is the theory of quantum geometry, okay? But before moving to the quantum geometry, let's see what quantum mechanics tell us. So general relativity was mainly the work of Einstein, but quantum mechanics is the work of many, many physicists. And here you can see this picture. So this picture was taken at the famous Solvay conference in 1927. And among these people, so you have 29 physicists here, and 17 got the Nobel Prize. So it's quite a good conference committee here. And if you look closely, there is only one woman here. Can you see her? And do you know who is here?
Marie.
Yeah, it's Marie Curie. But Marie Curie got 2 Nobel Prizes. So it's okay. For us women, the honor is safe thanks to her. Okay, so so this big group of people work on quantum mechanics, but let's just start with the simplest system that we have. So let's look at first at the hydrogen atom. So classically, it's described by the Coulomb interaction. And the issue with the classical description is that the hydrogen atom is unstable, okay? Whereas we know that it's supposed to be stable. So this was cured by the quantum description, where now we can see that only certain level of energy are authorized, okay? So we have a quantization of the level of energy. And one important point is here is that now we have a minimum energy, level of energy. So of course, the electron is not going to go onto the proton anymore, so we have this stability. And this can be interpreted by the fact that the quantum effect is acting like a repulsive force, and we're going that this is going to be important also for us in our case. So this kind of quantum repulsive force. Okay, so this is a very simple example. So what we want to put together now is general relativity and quantum mechanics. So from quantum mechanics, we know that any dynamical quantities are quantized, as we have seen with the hydrogen atom. And the world is formed by discrete quanta jumping over at space-time, on a flat space-time. Whereas in general relativity, you have a space-time which is curled, and everything is smooth and determinist. So if you look at these two theories, you have the feeling that you're looking at two very different worlds. So how can we put them together? And so this, of course, is one of the main issues is that you have conceptually two very different theories. So how can you reconcile them? But now let's just first focus on where quantum gravity could be used. So usually we are saying that the regime where quantum gravity is going to be present are the Planck regime. So what is this Planck regime, and how do we, in which situation do we get it? So the Planck length is quite small, as you can see, and you can get it if you look. So from quantum mechanics, if we look at the Compton wavelength, which is a property of particle, okay, it's a fundamental property of particle, and it also can be interpreted as the minimum. It can be interpreted as the minimum resolution that we can get. Okay, if we if we apply the uncertainty principle and we want to measure, for example, the size of a particle, the best resolution that we can get is going to be given by the Compton wavelength. So it's a kind of minimum length coming from quantum mechanics. And from general relativity, we have this Schwarzschild radius. So we know that if some mass if we compactify some mass under this radius given by the Schwarzschild radius, then what we get is a black hole. So what happens if we put together if the Schwarzschild radius is this minimum length? If we do this equation, then we are going to get what we call the Planck mass. And then if you put the Planck mass into this length, you find the Planck length. So what is this Planck length? What do you need to get this Planck length? This means that we need something quite small coming from quantum mechanics and something quite dense, okay, coming from general relativity. So where do we have something very dense and very small? Does this exist in the world? And indeed, if you look at the black hole, the singularity of the black hole is something very dense and very small. And it's the same with the Big Bang singularity. Okay, so we have at least two situations where we expect that quantum gravity is going to be useful to describe these two situations. So the singularity of a black hole and the Big Bang singularity. So this is really just a motivation why we need a theory of quantum gravity. Okay, so now how do we quantize? So I said that quantum mechanics tell us that any dynamical variables is quantized. What does it mean? How do we do that if we start from the classical system? So for example, if I give you the hydrogen atom described by the electrostatic Coulomb force, how do you give me the quantum system? How do you quantize starting from the classical description? So for the hydrogen atom, this can be done using the program done by Dirac, okay? And at the end, you end up with some quantum operator. So here it's an Hamiltonian. So the Dirac program, we are going to come back a lot on it, is a canonical quantization. So you need to first do the canonical analysis of your system and then apply this kind of recipe given by Dirac to build your quantum, to get your quantum system. Then let's try to look at a system a bit more complicated, already the electromagnetic force. We know that we can go to the, we have a quantum description which gives you the quantum electrodynamics. How do you quantize that? Already for this force, the Dirac program, this system is already too complicated to apply the Dirac program. We don't know how to do it. So then the solution has been found by Feynman. We propose a perturbative approach. Okay, so you all heard about the Feynman diagrams. And so you can use this technique to go to quantum electrodynamics. But you see that the Dirac program here is not applicable already. And then, of course, you can do that with the three forces, so the electromagnetic force, strong force, weak force, and what you get if you apply this quantization program is what we call the standard model. Can we do the same now with gravity? Apply Feynman, so the perturbative approach to gravity to get quantum gravity. So what does it mean to apply a perturbative approach? This means that now your metric, you want to look at some perturbation around A time mu nu, here is a flat metric, and you want to look at some H mu nu, so some small perturbation around this, this flat metric. So is that working? And the answer is it doesn't work, at least if we do the basic perturbation approach, because we can find that the theory is not renormalizable, what we call renormalizable. But so at this stage, then you have two options. Either you try to cure this perturbative approach, or you go back to Dirac approach. So the string theory approach was more trying to keep with this perturbative approach, of course, adding some new ingredients. So now you're working with strings, you have additional dimension, you have additional particles, the supersymmetric particles. So I'm not going to talk about this approach. I think the previous course was a course on string theory, so some of you should be familiar with this approach. But so again, so the second, if you don't want to keep the perturbative approach, the other solution would be to go back to Dirac approach and go to the canonical quantization. Because one idea is that since, for as I said now, the gravitational field is space-time. So you don't have any background anymore, any fixed background. So you want something background independent. And here, of course, when you start from a naive perturbative approach like this, you fix a flat space-time, eta mu nu. So you have a fixed background, okay, which seems not compatible with what GR is telling us. So the idea of loop quantum gravity here is to take very seriously general relativity, what we know from general relativity, in particular that we want something background independent, and try to apply the Dirac method to this, to general relativity. So really, we want to say that, take into account that GR is background, we want something background independent, the metric is the gravitational field, and from quantum mechanics, of course, we keep the uncertainty principle and everything. So from that, can we build a theory of quantum gravity, which will be a theory of quantum geometry? And this is what loop quantum gravity is trying to do. So to start from general relativity and try to apply the Dirac approach, which is a canonical quantization.
Do you mean that string theory is not background independent?
So the final, I don't know for the last development, but the first, initially, no, it was not in, so they are trying to become, but it's not the first ingredient, okay? They are trying to become a background element. Okay, so now how can this work? So the starting point is going to be an action from general relativity. So the action you should all know from your lecture from general relativity is the Einstein-Hilbert formulation, the Einstein-Hilbert action. And of course, for many years, people have tried to apply the Dirac approach to that. So the best development is what we call the ADM formulation, okay, where we still use the metric formulation. But then in the ADM formulation, at the end, you end up with an Hamiltonian, which is quite complicated, with some non-quadratic, non-polynomial. So it's very difficult to quantize. Okay, we don't know how to quantize the Hamiltonian in the ADM formalisms if we stick with the metric formulation of Einstein-Hilbert. So what makes that loop quantum gravity work? The first step was thanks to Ashtekar. In 1986, we proposed a new formulation of gravity. So instead of using the metric formulation, we are working with, here is a tetrad, or it's a triad. It's a densitized triad. And now we have a connection, which is a SU2 connection, which is quite similar to the Young-Mill connection you're working at. So it's this theory, written like this. This theory is very close to a Young-Mill theory, so we have plenty of method to apply. Okay, so one important point in this formulation is that now we have a parameter, the Barbero-Emirzi parameter, at least in four dimensions. Okay, we don't have this in three dimensions. So this means that we don't have only one set of what we call Ashtekar variables, but we have a family of variables. And at the classical level, everything is equivalent. But at the quantum level, it's going to give different theory. So I'm talking to you about this parameter, because at the end of this lecture, we will have a kind of guest speaker who is going to talk to you about some result on black hole in the loop quantum gravity framework. And this parameter is important. In fact, it is important as soon as we are going to talk about 4D gravity. But during this course, then we are mainly going to talk about 3D gravity, because we can do calculation and we can build the theory from the scratch. Okay. So these are the first step, this new variable. Okay. So instead of working with a metric variable, you're working with what we call the Ashtekar variable, and which is a triad and a connection. Then the second step is, of course, the loop. What do we call loop quantum gravity? So why do we use loop? Loop is going to be used to measure, we can use loops to measure curvature. Okay? So let's look, for example, at this plane. So if now I'm going to do this is my vector, and I'm going to do parallel transport on a closed loop with this vector. So if I'm starting here, I'm doing this parallel transport, and I'm closing the loop, so I'm coming back here at the starting point. You see that I still have the same vector, okay? And indeed, the curvature here is zero. I'm talking about a flat. So now I have this sphere, and I can do the same, okay? So let's start here. So we are in Toronto, more or less. So let's start on this slide, going to the equator, and going back, let's say, on Greenwich. And so I'm at the starting point, and you see that, so I started with a vector like this, with like my finger, and I'm finishing with this vector like this. So the parallel transport of this vector on a closed loop show me that I have a non-zero curvature, okay? So this is the second idea of loop quantum gravity. So the first important step was this change of variable. Second one is the use of this loop, okay, to measure the curvature of space-time. So this is exactly what I just did. But so the initial formulation was really of loop quantum gravity was really using loops. But now the formulation we have today is a bit more using another basis, which is a bit simpler, but we still keep the idea of the loop. It's just that we don't work only with closed loop. Now we are working with what we call the spin network. So the spin network are going to be, you are going to hear a lot this term, are going to be give a basis of the kinematical Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity. And what is a spin network? So a spin network is a graph. So it's not only closed graph, okay, with closed loop. It can be open now. And it's a decorated graph. So on each edge now, we are going to associate SU2 representation, okay, irreducible representation. And on each node, we're going to associate what we call an intertwiner, which is representation in the tensor product of the irreducible representation coming to this node. Okay, but we're going to come back on this description. But so these are what we call our fundamental excitation of space. Okay, and so what is the geometrical? So this spin network were introduced by these two researchers. So Lise Molin is here at PI, and Carlo Rovelli is based at Marseille. He's Italian, but he's working in Marseille. It's really the starting with Ashtekar. These two researchers are really the one who started the loop quantum gravity approach. Okay, so as I said, the spin network is what fundamental quantum excitation of space. And the geometrical interpretation is that we can show that each edge is going to carry a quanta of area, and each node is going to carry a quanta of volume. And the very important result of loop quantum gravity is that we have a discrete area operator and a discrete volume. So if you write the area operator, you can act on a spin network. So this is a spin network state. And this spin network state are going to diagonalize this operator. And what you find is that it's proportional to the Planck length, and we have a discrete area. So we are going to come back. And here you can see that again we have this emu z parameter coming in front of.
We are in three dimensions, right?
Yeah, but here it's so quantum for the moment. It's yeah. So maybe this was not clear yet. So the we are applying a Dirac approach. This means that we are doing a canonical quantization. So the first step is to quantize what we call the kinematical Hilbert space. So it's just space. Okay. So here it's really the fundamental excitation of space. And now, yeah, the next question is, and so what is the result we have here is that space is discrete. Okay. And you can see that as atom of space, okay, each of these nodes. So here it's going to give you this irreducible representation is related, as I said, is going to be related to the Planck, to the area, okay? And the intertwiner that we have here is related to the quanta of volume we have.
And when you, the psi kit that you have written, refer to one cell, or
this?
Yes.
Yeah, and sorry, I just noticing that I did a big mistake here. I'm forgetting the most important, because here it's not, you cannot see that it's really discrete. What is discrete is because here I'm missing the area on psi is going to be, so you have this factor, but then you have the irreducible representation of SU2 that you know that it's integral, half integral in front of, okay? And so this make what is, and so this is for, by, yeah, it's if it's for one edge, okay? By edge, this is going to be the.
But psi is one cell.
So psi here was one, what I call a spin network, okay? So it's one graph, okay? But then you're right that this formula, so if I'm just looking at one edge, so let's call E my edge, okay? Then here, this is really the SU2 irreducible representation associated to this given edge, okay? Okay, so this is the basic picture that you have here, and now the question is about the dynamics, because here in the canonical approach, what we need still to do is to solve the Hamiltonian constraint, and this is still in 4D, in four dimension, it's still an open problem. So one way to go is to look at the spin foam framework was introduced to try to solve this issue. And it's the idea is that to use the path integral a la Feynman. So I'm going to come back on that during the lecture. But what is the idea here is that, so this is what we could code a spin foam, okay? So now instead of graph, you have two cells, okay? And how can you interpret this? You can see that at the transition amplitude between spin network states of loop quantum gravity. So this is, let's say, your initial spin network state. With evolution in time, you end up with a new spin network state, and this gives you really the transition amplitude, okay? So this is what we call a spin foam. So what is the picture from loop quantum gravity and spin foam model is that now space is discrete, so you have atom of space, okay, and evolving in time. Okay, so this is the kind of picture that we have from the loop quantum gravity approach. So in this course, what we're going to do, we are going to focus on the 3D Euclidean gravity with a zero cosmological constant and on the loop quantum gravity approach mainly. Okay, so why? Because the idea, what I want to do is really to start, we are going to start from an action and really try to see what does it mean to quantize this action using the Dirac program. Okay, so it's of course not going to be easy even in 3D. So the advantage of 3D gravity is that it's a topological theory that we know how to quantize, and we even have several approaches that we can compare. So here we are going to focus mainly on the loop quantum gravity approach, but at the end of the lecture, we're also going to look at the spin foam approach to try to see, to compare. And hopefully then it's going to give you the tools of what is supposed to be done. And of course, I will tell you what are the difficulties in 4D, why we cannot just do as we did in 3D, where the difficulty come from, okay? So this is what, so just to summarize what we're going to do in the lecture, so what we want is a theory of quantum gravity. As I said, quantum gravity is general relativity and quantum mechanics that we try to put together. So from general relativity, we're going to start from an action. So what are the actions you know? I guess the N. From quantum mechanics, we're going to see what are the quantization approaches that we can use, acting, the starting point is going to be an action, and we're going to apply a quantization method on this action. So what are the action we can use from general relativity? So you should know from GR, your lecture on GR, the Einstein-Hilbert action, which is the written in terms of metric variables, but we're going to use what we call the first order action, which is a Palatini action written in terms of tetrad and connection, okay? So this is going to be our starting point. Then from an action, we are going to first study what are the symmetries, and we are going to go to the notion of gauge symmetry. What is a gauge symmetry? How can you read that from the action? What does it mean? And we are going to perform the canonical analysis of this action, see how the gauge symmetry appear in the canonical analysis. So we see that now we will have equation of motion which are going to be constrained, and depending on which kind of constraint we have here, we are going to have global symmetry or gauge symmetry, okay? So we are going to spend some time to talk about this because I think it's not going to be directly quantum gravity, but it's tools that you can use in other contexts, okay? It's not only going to be useful for you if you want to go on with loop quantum gravity, but it's going to be useful in many other approaches in physics, okay? And then, so from what are the quantization approaches we have? So we are going to focus on the canonical quantization by Dirac, but you also have the path integral quantization from Feynman. So from this, you can deduce the perturbative approach, but we have seen that for quantum gravity, naively, it's not going to work, so we are not going to focus on that now. So as a first example, before going to gravity, we are going to look at the simplest example, which is the parametrized particle, to see how this Dirac program is going to work step by step, okay? And then when we will be done, we're going to apply this program to the first order action, the Palatini action for gravity, and we're going to get what we call loop quantum gravity. And then if we apply the path integral quantization to this first order action, we're going to get a spin foam model, okay? So this is the idea of what we're going to try to do during this lecture. So really the first week is going to be not so much about quantum gravity itself, but really methods that can be, we're going to use the second and third week, but which can also be really useful for you in different contexts, okay? So of course, as I told you, one motivation to go to quantum gravity was that we had this Big Bang singularity. So what can we say about the Big Bang the Big Bang singularity? So in fact, this singularity is resolved by what we call loop quantum cosmology. So I'm not going to give you too many details today on that. But instead of a Big Bang, we are now a Big Bounce. Okay, so this is a kind of artistic picture of what we have, a pre-universe, and then this Big Bounce, and then our universe expanding again, okay? And so how does it work? So I haven't received so much of your. I send you some short to answer to let me know what you. Yeah, yeah, no worry. It's not urgent. But I have some of them, and it seems that not everyone took the cosmological, the course on cosmology. So I don't really know what you you know about it. But so the idea how it works here is that you see that the usual Friedmann equation that you have from GR now is modified, and you see that now A dot is not going only to vanish. Is going to change sign, and of course, it's what is going to happen at the Big Bang. But we will come back on that, and in particular, next week you will have more detail by Aurélien Barreau, which is really working on loop quantum cosmology. I'm not really working on that, but Aurélien Barreau is really a specialist, and is going to give you a kind of overview on what are the results on loop quantum cosmology and what are the predictions also we can do with loop quantum cosmology, which are quite important because even with the theory we have now of quantum gravity, we can make some prediction, which are important. And you will see that we will have a tutorial also talking about cosmology. So hopefully it's going to become more clear. And then the next, so the motivation for quantum gravity theory was the Big Bang singularity, but also the black hole singularity. So what can we say about black hole? And so now I'm going to talk, let Eugenio talk to you about that. So I think you don't need the slide, you just need the blackboard. So I'm done with the, thanks.
Okay, in these 15 minutes, I would like to tell you briefly about two puzzles and what loop quantum gravity has to say about them. But I think I should start with a fact, that is black holes are hot. And let me review it briefly because that's really the motivation. Okay? So let me start with something classical. You know that there's an instability in classical GR. So this is the first of these stabilities I'm going to speak about. This instability is the familiar one, is gravitational collapse. If at a certain time you have a distribution of matter, certain initial conditions, this is going to collapse and form a black hole. It's going to be a singularity. And an horizon is going to form. The origin of this instability, it is not present in pre-relativistic gravity, is that generally pressure stops the collapse. But what happens in general relativity is that once you reach a certain threshold, as pressure gravitates, it's not gonna stop the collapse, but actually enhance it. And you get a black hole, okay? And for what I'm gonna tell you, it's very useful, the right tool to think about this problem, say, is Penrose diagrams. So if you have not seen them yet, it's good investment. Most of the problems on black holes and quantum aspects of black holes are well formulated in terms of Penrose diagrams. So I'm just gonna give you the Penrose diagram for this same space-time gravitational collapse. Who of you is already familiar with Penrose diagrams? Say, more or less, more than half of the class, okay. So, this is the past. Future, you have matter that is falling, forms a singularity. This singularity, the red one, it's in your future if you fall into the black hole. And the event horizon is the surface. If you are in here, you cannot escape. You're going to end in the singularity. OK? So why I'm reviewing this in such detail, because I want to tell you first about a second instability. So this is an instability that is present in GR. It's gravitational collapse. The second instability requires GR plus quantum field theory, and it's also what is known as Hawking evaporation. It works this way. So I first give you the same picture that we saw before. You have matter, collapses, forms a black hole. There's a singularity that forms. Event horizon. Now on top of this, I'm gonna add some quantum fields, okay? So let's prepare the system. Let's start the process with a quantum field in the vacuum. Yeah. And that's what happens when this quantum field evolves in this space-time. It is changing in time. It's dynamical. So you should expect that the final state is not the vacuum. It's some other state. Okay? This is not so different from something that you are certainly familiar with. If you have an harmonic oscillator, you prepare it in the vacuum. And then the potential changes in time. For instance, it opens up, and then it comes back. You don't come back to the vacuum. You end up in some other state, okay? And that's what's happening here. Something is changing in time, and at a final time, at some late time, you get your black hole and a state of the field. Now, there are interesting properties of this state of the field. They are rather surprising. If you put a thermometer far away at late times, it's going to measure a temperature, the temperature of the black hole. And that's why I'm saying black holes are hot. Okay? So I'm going to put a thermometer here. This temperature is what is called the Hawking temperature. It's a quantum effect. There's an H bar. It depends on the mass of the black hole as the inverse of the mass. Okay? So, and this is the temperature you measure at late times and far away. So, a new quantity, it's good to have some numbers. Suppose that the black hole has Planck mass, you get a Planck temperature. Suppose that the black hole is a stellar black hole, for instance, mass of the order of 10 to the 30 kilograms, you will get 10 to the minus 8 Kelvin. So not really hot, in fact, quite cold, okay? However, this is a phenomenon that is conceptually important. This is what makes black holes an impressive theoretical laboratory for quantum gravity. But what I'm stressing here is you should not expect to see black holes radiating at least stellar black holes. If there are primordial black holes that are of small mass, then probably yes, but we have never seen them. Yes?
You said you put the thermometer far away. You mean,
yeah.
Does this observed temperature depend on the distance? I
mean, if you put it far away, it's independent of the distance.
So there is a non-zero temperature in the asymptotic limit.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I should make another remark at this point as I'm giving you a number. This mechanism is the same mechanism that provides the temperature anisotropies in the CMB. You start with a vacuum, you go through some dynamical spacetime, and you get some state. And in that case, in cosmology, you will get this temperature anisotropy that is related to a power spectrum, scalar power spectrum, that again depends on G, H bar, and the Abel rate at a mode that is crossing the Abel horizon in the past. And giving us a lot of phase. And this one has been measured. This is 10 to the minus 9. This has been measured by Planck. So what I'm saying is that these quantum effects, we trust them. We know that they are there. They have not been probed for black holes. There are other situations where they are important. OK. So once you know this, there's an immediate consequence. Once you know that an object is hot, you can ask what's its entropy. No? This is Bekenstein and Hawking. And I'm really going to follow the most simple approach. No? You know Clausius relation, heat exchange TDS. No? You perturb the black hole at fixed temperature. You ask how the entropy changes. Now, the energy exchange is a change in mass. T is this one, the temperature of the black hole, ds. So you have ds equal 1 over t, that is 8 pi g m dm over h bar. No? Using this one. Now recall that black holes have an horizon, and the horizon has an area, OK? Area 4 pi radius square. And clearly, everywhere I'm using C equal 1 and K Boltzmann equal 1. But I'm keeping G and H bar so that I know what is quantum and what is gravitational. So out of this, you put it here inside, and you see what you get. You get the variation of the area of whatever constant I need to reproduce the area here. And if you do this process from black hole to black hole zero mass, you get the entropy, and this is the black hole entropy, or Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, is the area for GH bar. And now this clearly brings us to our first puzzle. You have an entropy. We obtained it via thermodynamic arguments. We know that thermodynamics is an amazingly good description of a system with statistical mechanical properties. So what's the statistical mechanics behind this entropy? And I think that there's something to emphasize immediately. Statistical mechanics, origin of this humongous, huge entropy. Why huge? Because if you think as the entropy as the logarithm or the dimension or the part of the Hilbert space that you can actually access, for instance, this is a black hole of a given mass, so you should look at the Hilbert space of your theory, for instance, or look quantum gravity, in the shell, in the sector of that energy. No? Logarithm of this dimension should give you the area. That implies that the dimension of the Hilbert space relevant for our problem, should go as the exponential of the area in Planck units, or if you want, mass square over mass Planck square. So question you should ask is, do you know any system, any statistical mechanical system or any quantum system where the dimension of the Hilbert space scales with the exponential of the energy square? Most of the systems that you know go like the logarithm of the energy, or like the energy. You can think of some that go as the exponential of the energy. Yeah, one challenge is getting exponential of energy square. This is the first puzzle. There's a second puzzle that follows immediately from noticing that black holes are hot. If they are hot, there's radiation that is coming out at a temperature. That's how we measure that they are hot. No? Would be radiation going away like this. Well, the system is prepared in the vacuum. And at some point, you get it into this Hawking state. But if there's radiation is coming out, by energy conservation, this radiation should take away mass from the black hole. Right? So this is what I was telling you. There's a second instability, stability two. Classical general relativity, once you form a black hole, you stay with it. It's going to stay with you forever. Once you look at quantum effects can decrease the mass of the black hole, can make it shrink. Okay? This is an instability. So once you have an instability, the thing that you should check is what's the time scale of your instability. Okay? If it's too short, you don't see black holes at all. So it has to be something very slow. And this is really easy to estimate. So let me put it here. Can you read here, everybody? Yes, thank you. So front up. Nice. So energy conservation. No, very simple. Not introducing anything that is not familiar. Energy is going away from the black hole. The question is how fast? If you do the calculation of quantum field theory in Coarse space, you find the energy momentum tensor and the flux at infinity. The result, the thing that you learn, is that you get one Hawking quantum of energy. Well, you have a temperature, you can expect the energy. It goes like h bar over m. The larger the black hole, the more infrared the photons that come out. One for each horizon crossing time. That's the typical time scale. So the flux would be horizon crossing time is over the m, no? So h bar over m per unit time, h bar over m square. That's the typical flux from a black hole. And so now energy conservation tells you that the change in mass of the black hole, if you want m dot, is minus the flux. It is minus h bar over m square. Okay? So you can solve for m or t. It's an easy differential equation. T, m of t. You have your initial black hole that has a certain mass. In the beginning, it loses mass very slowly. And then you get this instability. It drains all the mass from the black hole in Hawking radiation. Because the smaller the black hole, the more it emits, the hotter it is. Okay? So this is the time scale that you are interested in. So this time, tau or tau Hawking, you can find it by solving this equation, and you find that the time scale is tau Hawking. It's a quantum effect, should go like h bar. It's h bar over the initial mass cubed. Okay?
How big is this cosmologically?
I'm sorry.
Compared to the range of the universe?
Yes. So that would be the inverse time scale. So that's better. No, when h bar goes to zero, lives forever. If you put in stellar mass black hole, you get 10 to the 74 seconds. Age of the universe is 13 billion years. 1 year is 10 to the 7. So quite big, no? So again, these kind of questions are really conceptual and of no direct effect that can be probed for stellar mass black holes. The only cases where this would be actually relevant is for small black holes. Okay? So if the black hole is going to disappear in a finite but very long time, then there's a second puzzle. And the second puzzle is that if you look at the picture, what you're going to get is that you start with a black hole, and its mass is going down. So the picture that you should think of is this one. Let me explain what's happening. So you had in the beginning your vacuum, then you started getting radiation that comes out. Radiation takes away mass from the black hole, and in the end you end up with radiation and no black hole. But we said that this radiation is thermal. So the initial state was the vacuum and classical matter. That is a state of zero entropy, it's a pure state. Well, the final state would be a state of radiation that is thermal, so it would have entropy, a huge entropy. And the puzzle is, how is that standard unitary evolution leaves you with a state that is not pure? No? Now, if you look at the picture, there's an immediate answer, but let me stress it anyway. So this is the most naive version of the information loss puzzle. It is, we started with a pure state. And we are ending with some state in the end. So this would be initial time, pure state, some other time, still pure. Late times, the black hole is not anymore there. You have only this radiation. So the question is the final state mixed? Clear what you're missing, no? You're missing everything that went into the singularity. Question is, do you remain with a space-time, with a field that is in a mixed state? Now, it's interesting that this problem can be sharpened and made relevant without going to the full evaporation of the black hole. And to look at that, you have to look at what happens comparing timescales. So you have a time, you have an entropy. The entropy of the black hole, we said it goes like the mass. So it starts with a certain mass. This is S naught, S black hole, P naught. And then it goes down as the mass goes down. OK? And then the radiation starts coming out. So this is the tau. While the radiation starts coming out, and the more radiation you get at a given temperature, the more entropy you get. And these two curves intersect somewhere. And there is where one expects some non-trivial effect to happen. So this time is called the page time. It's about when the black hole reaches half of its initial mass. OK, so these are the puzzles. Now, in the last minute, I would like to tell you briefly what quantum gravity, in particular Luke quantum gravity, can tell us about these puzzles. So puzzle one, the entropy. So it's clear that to accommodate this entropy, you need a huge Hilbert space. And Maite already told you that there's this Hilbert space of spin networks. So at a given time, you should think of
these graphs that corresponds to quantum geometry with quantized areas, quantized volumes, and now you look at a region. And the question is, can this region accommodate this huge number of states? Okay? Well, the first result is that you can look simply at the Hilbert space supported on the boundary of the region, and the number of states scales like the exponential of the area in Planck units. So this is a good indication that you can accommodate it. So this is a first fact. This is something that is known and has been computed in 2000 by Ashtekar and collaborators. There are questions that are open, difficult questions. When you think about a black hole, what you are interested in is what's the relevant portion of the Hilbert space once you identify the physical sector. You fix the energy at infinity or the mass, and you ask for the state inside. And for instance, you could have a pure state, and now you look at a subregion, and you compute the entanglement entropy of the subregion. Is it going to reproduce that formula? That's the first question. But before computing that, there's something more difficult to address. That is, how do you relate the mass of the black hole, that is something you measure from far away, to states on the horizon? And something that you are going to learn in this course is that the Hamiltonian constraint relates variables inside to variables to the boundary. And that's the first ingredient, the first step in this direction. Puzzle two. Curvature is bounded. Yes.
I have just a question. I mean, I have some little bit of information about how to calculate the entropy. And usually, when you calculate inside using the von Neumann formulation, you find it infinite. So you should regulate, use some regulator to find something like Wittgenstein.
Yeah. So in this theory, there is a physical regulator. It's a Planck scale regulator that answers your question. It has a second effect. It bounds the curvature. So this is something that you are going to see from Aurélien Barrault's lecture on quantum cosmology. For the Big Bang singularity, you get that it's resolved in the sense that you have a maximum curvature. For black holes, the expectations or the scenario is that this singularity is going to be smeared. You get a quantum region. So this is the picture that you should have in mind. The singularity is resolved. You have a quantum region. You enter this quantum region. There's matter that goes in. There's some notions that are relevant. That is, for instance, the notion of dynamical horizon. There's the radiation is coming out. This is Hawking radiation. And then there's other radiation that's coming from this quantum region, Planck radiation. And it's clear once you look at this picture that the initial state was pure, and the final state can still be pure. In fact, it has to be pure because there's no singularity. There's no sink where information can go. The current difficult question is, can we compute time scales? Because this now is a third kind of instability. It's an instability for the curvature. Instability for the curvature singularity. It disappears, and the question is, what is the time scale? Because this can change completely these estimates. Here we were saying way larger than the age of the universe, assuming that quantum field theory and general relativity apply up to that scale. Here, there's something that can happen. It should happen before, otherwise it doesn't solve the puzzle. And the difficult question is finding, this is a mechanism, finding an implementation and finding time scales. Let's stop here. Thank you very much.